You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Hi, I'm Anna Sale in for Leonard Lopate today. If someone starts telling you he was abducted by aliens or that he doesn't think the Holocaust happened, your first instinct might be to bolt. But these are exactly the kinds of people investigative journalist Will Storr seeks out. He examines the minds of skeptics, cynics, and non-believers he calls unpersuadables, intelligent people who refuse to bend their beliefs to fit the mainstream despite evidence that should convince them that their beliefs are all wrong. It's also the title of his new book, The Unpersuadables: Adventures with the Enemies of Science. It's published by Overlook Press, and I'm glad it brings Will Storr to the Leonard Lopate Show today. Hello, Will.
Hi.
I want to start by asking, this is your second book you've written about people who hold less than mainstream beliefs. The first was Will Storr versus the Supernatural, in which you went in search of people who believed in ghosts. What's interesting to you about these people?
I think the real reason is that I was raised in a very strict Catholic household, and I was raised as an atheist, and I don't even remember, you know, believing in Santa Claus when I was young. I've got very vivid memories of being at a church school and being told these Bible stories and thinking, this just sounds like craziness to me. And I think with my parents, my dad was, went to Oxford University. He was a very intelligent man. And yet he believed these things that I always found kind of incredible. And as I've grown older, I've become aware that that's kind of caused a separation between us. And I think, the itch that I always want to scratch with my work is to find out why intelligent people come to believe things that I would consider kind of a bit nuts. You know, what is it? What are the processes? I just want to understand, what's going on behind the scenes in their minds, really.
So this book is a series of profiles of people that you call the enemies of science. So first, what was your pitch to these people when you were trying to set up interviews? How did you approach them, and what did you say you wanted to find out?
There are a lot of profiles, but it's also a journey, that I sort of go through as the book goes on. So my pitch was really that that it was a book about really the psychology of belief. What is it that makes people brave enough and headstrong enough to kind of stand up to the orthodoxy when it comes to these holding these unlikely beliefs? I mean, for example, David Irving, the controversial right-wing historian who has a reputation for minimizing the Holocaust and defending Hitler. This is a man who has gone to prison for his beliefs. He's seen his career trashed for his beliefs, and yet he still perseveres in this insane idea that he holds, that Hitler was a friend of the Jews. That's what he says. Hitler was a friend of the Jews. This guy used to be a really well-respected historian. What is going on there? I just found that fascinating.
And what did you find out by spending time with David Irving?
Well, David Irving, I spent 7 days with him. I mean, that was a really quite a difficult week, because what he does, he had a very difficult libel trial, and it was difficult in that he lost £2 million. So he was declared bankrupt, and the only way he can make money now is by holding these annual holidays where he goes to Europe and tours Holocaust sites, and neo-Nazis basically pay $2,500 to join him on these holidays. So I went. I paid my $2,500. So it wasn't just David Irving. It was with lots of people who are actually much further to the right than David Irving and are kind of out-and-out Holocaust deniers. And what I found was, for me it was fascinating, especially these other people, because many of them, a lot of them, had German parents who served in the war. I mean, on the last night, there was it was arranged that we would all have a viewing of the film Downfall, which, as you probably know, is the German movie which depicts the final days in Hitler's bunker. And one of these guys didn't want to watch it, because his father was there, actually in the bunker with Hitler, and he found it too emotional, too upsetting to watch. It was, too awful for him. And what I came away from that was this very strong feeling that these were men who had, who had been raised loving their mums and loving their dads, as we all do, and thinking their mums and dads were wonderful, caring people. And yet raised in a world where Nazi is a synonym for evil, where people were saying the Nazis were awful people, they did these awful, inhuman things. And what these people wanted to do was just almost on a mission of love to restore the reputation of their beloved mums and dads in the face of all this evidence. And I think that's what was going on. I mean, that was my takeaway, was that these people were just refusing to believe that their mums and dads could be these monsters.
How did that feel, spending time touring sites, Holocaust sites, with a band of people who are actively denying the suffering and torture and death that occurred there?
It was pretty awful. I mean, I've been doing this for quite a long time. I've been a journalist for like 14, 15 years now. And I'm used to spending maybe 2 or 3 days with people who I might find kind of objectionable, their views objectionable. This was a whole week, and it was undercover too. Like, the people I was there with didn't know that I was a journalist. They just thought I was researching this book of psychology. So it was really difficult. I've already described myself as an atheist, but the worst moment for me was when we were in Majdanek concentration camp, where, you know, tens of thousands of people, Jews died, and there was a tour group going through the gas chambers, actually in the gas chambers, and there was a tour group with these young teenage girls who were, some of them were in tears, very emotional, and David Irving actually like barracking the leader of this group, telling them that what they were seeing was rubbish, that these weren't gas chambers, they were air raid shelters. And it disturbed me so profoundly that I actually left what was happening and stood in the monument, which is in one of the buildings, and I actually crossed myself and prayed. And I haven't prayed since I was a child. You know, I just felt this overwhelming sense of, you know, something really disturbing and dark happening. I mean, and I've written about that in the book. I still can't explain why my instinct was to pray. So, I mean, that's maybe an indication of how difficult I found it. Mm.
And David Irving himself, you mentioned there had been a long court case where his research and his evidence had been very closely scrutinized. I mean, how after that process did he still come away defending his analysis of what had happened during World War II and during the Holocaust?
Absolutely. And I put this question directly to him, as you might imagine. And again, I find this absolutely fascinating because, I mean, the first thing is that people assume generally that David Irving was sued. That's not actually the case. David Irving sued an American historian, Deborah Lipstadt, because she called him a Holocaust denier. So he voluntarily brought about this overwhelming dissection and analysis in a court of law of his work as a historian. So, I mean, that shows the level to which he believes what he's saying. I mean, he really believes it. So he represented himself, even. I mean, he really thought he was going to win this. And I put it to him afterwards, you know, I mean, he was destroyed in the court. I mean, there was, you know, lie after lie after, well, I say lie, I think that's wrong, error after error after error after error. And I said, having been through this process, you know, how has it changed your mind? And he said, he plumped himself up. And he said, well, after all of that work, they only found 12 errors in my work. 12 errors. And, you know, you show me another historian that could undergo that level of scrutiny, and they could only find 12 errors. I mean, it was quite extraordinary. So, you know, he left that feeling even better about his work as a historian. And this is perfectly natural. This is confirmation bias, the psychological process which we all go through, whereby, you know, we feel like we are examining the views of our opponents. But what we're actually doing is looking for ways of dismissing their arguments, as would a prosecution lawyer. And once we've gone through this process, we feel actually better about our views than we did before our views were attacked.
So that was David Irving, who denies that Hitler knew about the Holocaust.
That's correct.
You also wrote about John McKay. Tell me about him.
Yeah, so John was a creationist, and he was at the very beginning of my journey, the journey that I go through in The Unpersuadables. He is quite an influential guy. He's an Australian, but he's influential both in America and in the UK. He's very he believes in preaching creationism at schools, teaching it as something alongside evolution. He believes that evolution is the work of the devil. He thinks the Earth is 6,000 years old. But he also sees himself as a scientist. I mean, he said he was going to, spend 3 days proving to me that evolution was a lie and that the Earth was 6,000 years old using the methods of science. Obviously, that didn't go very well for him. But again, yet again, we saw this guy that was absolutely convinced of his views despite all of the evidence against it. and absolutely, not a stupid man. I mean, I think a lot of people, when they hear about these people, they think, oh, well, they're just stupid, they're ignorant. You know, John Mackay is neither stupid nor ignorant. He's a very intelligent guy, and he's not ignorant because he debates people in public debates. He debates evolutionists. He knows all their arguments. He knows all their evidence, and yet he still clings to these beliefs. I mean, and that was the very beginning of my journey, because it suddenly occurred to me, this guy's not stupid, but facts don't work with him. You can fire, I went to my interview with him with a list of these facts, and I thought, this is going to be great, because I'm going to tell him these facts, and they're going to destroy his argument. And I don't know why I expected, him to kind of, crumble in front of me. But of course, he knows all the answers, and he bats them back. And, I left sad that I hadn't achieved my goal of kind of destroying him. But also, my fascination was increased. Why don't facts work? What is it about human beings that we are just invulnerable to the assault of evidence?
I'm speaking with Will Storer. His new book is The Unpersuadables: Adventures with the Enemies of Science. And on John Mackay, when you presented these facts, did it just seem like he had a contrarian personality, or there was ego involved in some way that he wasn't able to listen? What did you see actually operating?
Well, what I found with John Mackay and a lot of these people, well, all of them, in fact, and it took me doing a lot of work finding out about the psychology and neuroscience of belief to discover this, and it's just, how do all humans come upon the things that they believe? And what I found is that we are, we're not rational creatures. We're emotional creatures. So we'll believe the things that we feel to be true, not the things that we're told is true. So John Mackay is a very right-wing person. He ticks all those very right-wing boxes. He's a conservative. He's a homophobic, very homophobic. He's a staunch right-wing person. So his emotional instincts when he, say, on the homophobia issue, when he sees gay people, unfortunately, his emotional response will be something like disgust. And what we do, we don't look out into the world and rationally assess facts and decide which facts we're going to accept on the basis of how true they are. We accept the facts on how true we feel they are. Now, if you're somebody that is disgusted by gay people, you're going to look for a belief system that reinforces and justifies those beliefs. So John Mackay is a person who has found Old Testament Christianity to justify his beliefs. I mean, none of us wake up in the morning and believe that we're evil people. I mean, I sat down with John Mackay and I told him that what you've told me today, I just see an evil person. This is evil. If the world believed as you believe, there would be a genocide against gay people. But I mean, he instantly rejected that. But he has to wake up in the morning and feel like the hero of a story. And so the way he does that is by embracing Old Testament Christianity and going out into the world and preaching it, and feeling as if he's doing, God's work, this fantastic work.
And in that conversation where it was the two of you, was he trying to convince you?
No, interestingly, he wasn't. I think he knew that there was little chance of that. He was basically telling me that I was going to hell. I mean, that was his thing. And I'd actually planned, I thought, I'm going to have to confront this guy. So I actually knew I was going to sit down and just say, look him in the eye and say, look, John, he actually did a big sermon in church, which he invited me to, where he talked about non-believers in gay people going to hell. And I felt it was kind of directed, at least in part, at me, because he did look at me at certain key points. He looked directly at me. And I thought, okay, I'm going to sit down with him afterwards. I'm going to say, what I heard from you today was evil. And I thought he was going to be angry about that or insulted. And he wasn't. He just took it very, accepted it matter-of-factly. And he just said, I'm not surprised you think that, because it was confronting stuff. But, this is what it says in the Bible. This is God's word. Man doesn't get to alter or adjust God's word, so this is what we must believe. I mean, so he was very placid about it, and there was no attempt to kind of convince me that I was wrong.
I'm speaking with journalist Will Storer about his book, The Unpersuadables: Adventures with the Enemies of Science, and what drives some people to cling to certain beliefs in the face of overwhelming scientific evidence. It's published by Overlook, and we'll have more after a break. I'm Anna Sale, in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Will Storer. He's the author of The Unpersuadables: Adventures with the Enemies of Science. And Will, I want to ask you, this book was published in the UK with the title The Heretics, and here it goes by The Unpersuadables. Why the change?
Well, actually, that's interesting. That is Overlook Press, the US publisher. As soon as they decided they wanted to publish the book, they said to me, look, we'd love to publish this, but we can't publish it under the title The Heretics in the States because it's such a loaded word in America. I mean, and their feeling was that people would look at it and think it's just a book about religion or about God. I don't know how right or wrong they are on that, but I certainly put my faith in my American publisher to know American culture better than I do. So, I mean, so there was this idea that, I don't know what you think, but apparently heretics has a very religious connotation in America.
I want to dig down a little bit into what differentiates most of us from the select group of unpersuadables that you looked at. You talked about confirmation bias before the break. Don't we all have confirmation bias to some extent?
Well, we do. And again, this was another one of the things that really struck me, was that these processes, you know, these ways in which these unpersuadables have thought their way into these extreme positions are no different from... they're not thinking in a different way from you or me. We all have confirmation bias. We all, you know, we all experience our lives as this kind of hero quest in which we're kind of struggling against great odds to make better lives. So we all have these inherent biases in the way we think. The only difference with the people who I cover in the book is that they seem to have thought their way into much more extreme positions. And I think a lot of that is to do with personality. I mean, the personality of David Irving, he's very much somebody that likes to make a fuss. He's very much somebody that likes attention. I mean, one of the things he said to me was, I'm always looking for puddles to stamp in. I think that's the only difference. I mean, I worked out very early on that if I was going to find out why people hit upon crazy beliefs, I'm just going to have to find out how anybody hits upon any belief. And I found out that they're exactly the same processes.
Tell me about confabulation. How does that work?
Confabulation is a fascinating... that's one of the things that really struck me the most. I mean, this is really an extraordinary thing, and that's that we don't really know why we do the things that we do. So we act mostly unconsciously, or so I'm told. So most of the decisions that we make, most of the things that we do, that's the instruction of our unconscious minds, which we have no access to. Our conscious minds don't have any access to that at all. So what our conscious minds do, there's a neuroscientist called Marco Gazzaniga, who's done most of the work on confabulation. He calls it that we have this storytelling module, and that we tell a story to explain to ourselves why we've done a certain thing. I'm going to try and explain this in a way that's understandable. It's quite complicated. but Gazzaniga did these amazing split brain experiments, and there are people who have very bad epilepsy, and to stop them having these terrible epileptic fits, they have the hemispheres of their brains cauterized, so there's no communication between the left-hand side and the right-hand side of their brain, and they can operate perfectly normally like that. But without going into very technical detail, it means that you can do experiments on these people where you can, in effect, separate the unconscious and the conscious parts of their minds. So there's a way in the lab which they can communicate unconsciously with these people. So they hold up a sign to the unconscious part of their minds that says, walk. And so this patient, without having any conscious awareness that they've been told to walk, will get up and go and get a drink from the kitchen. And when you say to that person, why did you get up? Why did you go and walk over there? They'll go, oh, because I was thirsty. And it wasn't because they were thirsty at all. It was because they were told to walk. Now, these people, these split brain patients, are just the same as you and I. You know, we're all, to a greater or lesser extent, depending on which scientist you ask, behaving unconsciously. We think we know why we're doing the things we're doing, but that's a confabulation. That's the brain just making up reasons why we're doing what we're doing.
So connect me.
This is profound. This is really disturbing when you think about it, that we don't know why we do the things we do. We're just told this kind of running lie, this running kind of best guess by our conscious minds.
And connect that back to an attachment to a narrative that climate change is incorrect or is not happening or the Holocaust did not happen. What is the process happening there?
Our brain works is that we tell ourselves why we're doing what we're doing. We tell ourselves why we believe what we believe. And these are confabulations. These might be right. I mean, the guesses might be right, but they are just guesses. So, you know, if you ask somebody like, say, for the climate change piece, I spoke to a guy called Lord Christopher Monckton, who's a well-known British, used to be an advisor to Margaret Thatcher. He's very popular in the American Tea Party movement. He's a very prominent climate change denier. If you ask him, you know, why do you believe that climate change science is a lie, he'll tell you all sorts of reasons about data and science, but he doesn't know the reasons. The reasons are unconscious. He'll be being told a very convincing story about all the reasons, but they're not the real reasons. That's a confabulation, and that isn't just Monckton. That's all of us.
I found that so compelling that at the end of the book you came to just this idea of our great attachment to narrative and the difficulty of crawling out once we've grabbed on to one version.
Yeah, I call this process the hero makeup. I mean, it's kind of shorthand for this idea that we're all living our lives. I mean, it's no coincidence the classic hero narrative in which, you know, this plucky David versus David is fighting these Goliaths, fighting against great odds to kind of build this better life. You know, that is how we all experience our lives. Time and time again, when I talk to these people, they would describe themselves as David against Goliath. You know, Lord Monckton, he's this David fighting the Goliath of the UN, who are trying to take over the world with this climate change lie. Yeah, or David Irving, who's this David against the Goliath of the Jewish lobby, trying to spread their lies about the Holocaust and World War II, etc. You know, we all experience our lives like this, and that is how we, to a greater extent, that is how we decide who's right and who's wrong, which facts to believe, which facts bolster this hero narrative. So Lord Monckton, when I didn't even interview him, I just said, tell me your story. And out popped this wonderfully colourful tale about the evil totalitarian left who are using the KGB communist playbook in order to undermine the right because they're jealous of wealthy people. And the way they're doing that is by attacking the energy infrastructure of the West. And that's with climate change science. And by doing this, they're going to destroy the capitalist economies of the West. And they're going to take over the world. And he sees himself as this kind of fighter against this evil conspiracy. So you begin to understand why you can have a row with Lord Monckton or any climate change denier about what the hockey stick graph means, or, you know, this data point or that data point or this study. But it's not going to have the slightest bit of effect because it doesn't affect this narrative. It's the whole of his world that he's this David versus Goliath character. It's the whole of this world that the left is a totalitarian, jealous ideology that's trying to take over the world. Using the process of confirmation bias, he looks out into the world and he sees evidence for this every minute of every day. So no matter how compelling the science looks, to him it can't be true because everything he sees reinforces this other world that he's living in. And so I think that's why, not just him, all of us decide what to believe is by, you know, it's by who we are, by the identity that we have, by the nature of this David fighting this Goliath, which is, you know, all our enemies.
And Will Storr, one of your identities is as a journalist. Was this fundamentally kind of upsetting that the idea that if you went out and reported and discovered facts and explained it clearly, that it didn't matter? Was that upsetting?
I think actually no. I think there are two kinds of journalists. There are the journalists who have this great desire to kind of speak truth to power, and they're the Watergate journalists, and I admire those people endlessly, but they're not me. They're the news reporters. I'm very much a long-form writer who are just fascinated by people and what makes people tick, and we tend to be the people that are more attracted to kind of long-form feature writing. So it wasn't kind of upsetting, because it's not why I do what I do. What I do is to try and understand people. So I think I found it, I mean, it's a bit depressing, but I think I find it more interesting than upsetting.
And how do you think about truth?
Well, I mean, what emerges from the book is a great defense of the scientific process, because, you know, that's the way that humanity is, that's the method by which humanity is created, which destroys the process of these psychological biases. It destroys the powers of these narratives by which we live our lives. You know, by using data and by peer-reviewed studies, it's an not an ideal system, it's not a perfect system, but it works, and that's what it does. It takes away prejudice and bias. I mean, another interesting thing, though, I think when you actually, and I do in this book, actually go down to the level of the individual scientist, what you find is they're just as bad as the rest of us, you know, no matter how, even if they are incredibly steeped in the literature, in the academic work, they just end up waving meta-analyses at each other and calling each other names, as they actually do at one point in my book. But if you take the macro view and look at the scientific process in general, I mean, that's how we advance. And we advance because, as I say, the process destroys the dominion of the narrative. It gets rid of all that rubbish. And it enables us to find something like truth.
At the same time, near the end of the book, you write, "Bring on the psychics, bring on the alien abductees, bring on 100 of them. To be mistaken is not a sin. Wrongness is a human right."
Absolutely. And another thing I discovered in the book was that some of the people who I previously would identify with, so the skeptics, the atheists, the Richard Dawkins fans, are just as blinkered and are just as kind of glued into this David versus Goliath narrative as anybody else. What I kind of felt as I mixed with some of these, you know, quite angry atheists was what they wanted was a world in which everybody was the same. And it reminded me of, you know, when I've reported from, there's a refugee camp in northern Kenya on the Somali border called Dadaab. It's the world's largest refugee camp. And I spent a week there reporting a few years ago. And I found that depressing because, you know, everybody was the same. They were all, you know, very strict Muslim. They were, all the men said they were called Muhammad. They were all, you know, all they would talk about was their religion. It was really depressing. It was really anti-life. It was really oppressive. And I kind of felt as if the Dawkins people were kind of pushing for the same kind of world where we're all these kind of very nerdy, analytical, rational people. And I love crazy people. I love hanging out with UFO spotters. And I love the fact that people believe in ghosts and have all these wild and wacky beliefs. I think it's, you know, it's the richness of our species. It's fantastic, as long as they're not doing any harm. And that's where I draw the line. I think when you get to people like the anti-vaccination people, where they're actually harming other people, I think that's where you have to draw the line.
And what's your tip for how to draw that line if you say it's very difficult to make them listen?
My tip in how to draw the line.
How do you communicate that you're drawing the line? How do you say, no, what you're saying is wrong and dangerous and has consequences?
Well, I think we've got a system already to do that, and that's the law. I think a lot of the skeptical community talk about homeopathy, and they talk about the people who refuse to give their children conventional medication, insisting homeopathic medication will do the job and the children pass away. But what happens is those parents go to prison. So I think we already have a system in place to deal with that. I think you could argue that that system needs to be tightened up and there needs to be more laws put in place for, you know, we have, I don't know what the laws are in the States, but in the UK we have laws against incitement to violence. You know, if you say things about, you know, a racial group which is likely to lead to violence, you get prosecuted for that. And I would argue perhaps for similar laws for people who are spreading mistruths about vaccinations, because these are people who are actively going out there and causing harm. And I agree that they believe every word of what they're saying. They're not evil in the sense that they're calculating and nasty. They've made a mistake, and their mistakes are powerful to them. They believe what they're saying is the truth. So I kind of, in a way, feel sorry for them. But they're harming other people's children. So the law needs to kind of step in there and do something.
And finally, you said at the top that one of the reasons you've been interested in talking to these sorts of people is having grown up an atheist in a Catholic household. And I wonder, just at the end of your reporting, how do you think about your beliefs and how you know what you believe?
I'm much more humble about what I believe now. I look at my fellow journalists, especially the ones who write columns and get very angry about the issues, which I know that they know very little about. And I think, you know, you shouldn't be so sure about what you're saying. You know, I'm as a journalist, I'm lucky enough to, you know, to have the time to do reporting, and I have to ask people of opposing beliefs what they believe before I come to my own opinions. But even then, I'm much more cautious now about what I'm saying and what I'm thinking. And I know, I mean, the red light for me, the alarm, is that when I'm feeling very emotional about something, if I'm very emotional about a particular belief, I know that I'm on dangerous ground, because it's when we're emotional that we're irrational and that we can't trust our own beliefs.
I've been speaking with journalist Will Storr about his book, The Unpersuadables: Adventures with the Enemies of Science. It's published by Overlook. Will, thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.